Welcome, everyone, to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast with Greg Kogel and me, Amy Hall.
And here we are, well into the new year.
Yes.
And I have not finished my Christmas shopping yet.
Now you're going to confuse everyone, Greg.
Because we are recording a week before Christmas.
Yeah, we're recording a little bit early.
And although this might be true when this airs, we'll
see. Let's hope not, Greg. All right. This first question comes from Rinchen.
Rinchen.
Okay. I was listening to one of your past podcasts about NDEs, and a thought came
to me. Near-death experiences.
Yes. Why do you think our physical bodies have eyes and ears when it seems that the soul is capable of apprehending sights and sounds without them?
Oh, that's an interesting question. What it appears, and I think the way J.P. Moreland would express it, is that our souls are limited by the capability of the body when it's united with the body. I mean, one could ask a kind of a parallel question, since there is such thing called remote viewing, where the soul could leave the body and go to a different location and view things. So that's where the eyes, they can see with the eyes, but they're also jetting around, you know, at like light speed to these different locations. And, why do we need a body when just by the soul we can jet around to these different locations? And because we can't do that in a body, and that would be nice, zip, zip, zip. But God purposed that our invisible selves would be joined to our physical selves for a reason. I don't know the reason, but that's his purpose. He made us that way, and so much so that when there is a separation, it's considered a tearing away and a nakedness that needs to be restored. And this is why Paul talks about this. You know, we long to be clothed in a physical body, and he's speaking there specifically of a resurrection body untainted by sin. But the separation of the soul from the body in the state period between death and ultimate resurrection is a foreign set of affairs. There are qualities and capabilities we have during that time, but what God has designed for the best, and I don't know how to cast the best out in that case, I'm just saying that this is God's design, is for the two to be together. And so not only must we have eyes to see, for our soul to see when we're united with our body, we have to use legs to get places. We can't just fly around like Peter Pan. And so at least in these physical bodies, what the resurrection body is going to be capable of doing is, I'm not sure. But I've had these instances, though, two things that I think of, actually three of them. Sometimes when I dream, and I dream somewhat vividly, I dream that I'm in heaven or I'm there. I can't tell you what it looks like. It's not an NDE or anything like that. But the awareness, the sensation I have is one of complete lack of worry and concern and utter and complete safety. And frankly, I do not want to wake up because it is so wonderful to feel completely stress-free in the sense that I have nothing to be concerned about or worried about. There are other times when I feel like I'm running. I don't run anymore. I used to do that, but I don't because of my back, my legs. But here I'm just running full tilt with no strain on me. It doesn't feel like it's any effort to do this. I like the feel of running. And I also get that feeling when I do my first 25 yards of swimming in the pool, my first length. I'm swimming. I hardly even need to breathe. It's just easy. No oxygen debt, no tiredness. I'm just stroking and stroking, and I'm just flying along, and I'm thinking, this is wonderful, till I get to the end of the pool, and then I'm going, you know, kind of thing. But so there are times when we have little sensations, little opportunities where, you know, it just seems, oh, you get a taste of what it must be like without having our bodies and souls, but where there is no liabilities to being encased in flesh like we have now.
I also think...
I should say enclosed in flesh.
Just because you you know, even if we could just see things with our soul, if we're going to interact with our environment, don't we need a physical body? God's able to do any, God's only spirit, and he's able to interact with any sort of matter and do whatever, any sort of interaction with matter he desires.
They call it psychokinesis. You know, you move things with your mind.
Right, but we...
Is that what that's called?
Something like that.
Yeah. Autokinesis.
Kinesis?
Maybe it's kinesis. Anybody who can do that, raise my hand. Anyway.
But we're limited. We're not like God. We need bodies in order to interact
with
the world. And so it's more than just seeing in things. We want to be able to interact and with other human beings and with other things in our environment.
There are unique pleasures, too, that are associated with body, like eating, for example. And so if we're going to eat and enjoy the flavors, that seems to be connected to a physical process.
So anyway, those are my thoughts. I haven't thought too much about this.
Yeah. But it's a fair question. You know, it's good that people are thinking beyond, outside of the envelope.
So here's a question from Rolf Anderson. There being some desires not fulfilled on this earth points us to having been made for another world.
That's Lewis's argument.
Right. So then he says, generally, our mind and body struggle against death. We desire to remain alive. Does this desire point to heaven's non-existence, i.e. that there is nothing after death?
No, it seems to be just the opposite. If we desire to stay alive, then that implies there is a fulfillment of that desire, which is eternal life. I'm misunderstanding the question. It seems it goes the other way.
Yeah, I guess what he's saying is if we're trying not to die, since death is the doorway to life. But I think that's the answer.
Yeah, and the reason that people desire let me back up. Some people desire not to die because they are convinced there is nothing after this, and you've got to get it all done in your 4 score and 10. Other people who understand it's beyond that, still death is a frightening physical experience. Now, that fear can be overcome with certain type of mental attitude, and some Christians experience that mental attitude that helps them completely overcome, because they are able to internalize the idea that the fear of death is sin, and Jesus has overcome that, and so now we're moving on to graduation. And many Christians, I think, are able to just make that transition without any palpable fear. Yet, I know if somebody pointed a gun at my head, my palms would sweat. And a couple times when the airplane is taking a lurch, I'm thinking, well, if I go down, I go down. I'm going to be with the Lord. All right, no worries. But then the airplane lurches and I'm in a bad situation, I'm wondering, is he going to come out of this steep turn here? Then I get butterflies. And, so I think that's just a natural reaction of our fleshly, and I mean human body nature kind of response of self-preservation, which is a healthy instinct.
And like you said, this eternal life is what you're after when you're trying to avoid death. And that is what, as he said, a desire not fulfilled on this earth. So it goes back right to the same thing, like you said.
It seems like the same kind of argument in play here. I do know, though, I don't want to die right away. There's too many other things that, to me, are satisfying this life that I'd like to see happen and have fulfilled and accomplish. And even though I know that in a certain sense, I'd be going to some greater thing. So there's a tension there for me.
Oh, even Paul said that. He said, I don't know if it's better to go and be with Jesus or to stay here and help you, because you need that help.
Right.
All right.
He had more noble reasons for staying on earth than I do.
Okay, here's a question from Jamie Howe. How can we respond to the notion that each person is their own authority?
Well, I guess the first question is, what do they mean by that? And the second question is, if they say, well, I get to do anything I want as long as I'm not hurting anybody, well, then how are you an authority if you are restricted by some other requirement? I mean, you could challenge that. That's kind of the minimalist ethic. They have a minimal requirement for good, and that is I'm not hurting someone else. There are all kinds of problems with the minimalist ethic. I've written a piece, I think it's still on our website, called The Minimalist Ethic Too Minimal. So because morality entails a whole lot more than just the harm principle, that we are not to cause harm. Maybe we have an obligation to do good to others. Maybe we have an obligation not to harm ourselves, or to do, and if we're not harming somebody else, but we are harming ourselves, then that maybe that's a factor there. But I would ask them, oh, okay, so then do you and I both have that same right to authority, to be our own authorities? Okay, now what happens when what I want to do according to my authority conflicts with what you want to do according to your authority? How do we work that out? Now, notice those are questions, but they're going to the heart, I think, of a conflict here. And this is the problem with do your own thing. Everybody wants everybody else. No, let me back up. I say this in the relativism book. Everybody wants to be a relativist, but they don't want anyone to be a relativist towards them. So that's, I think, the problem.
Yeah, so taking the roof off for them and showing them what the result is if you have two people who say they're an authority, I think everyone can understand that need for something above us that can adjudicate between the two claims to authority.
Yes, and the only way they can adjudicate is by having a morally superior rule that judges between them. But if there's no God, there are no such things as morally superior rules. So you can't even make the claim that I have a right to mine own authority. There is no right to one's own authority if there are no rights. And there can't be any rights if there are no moral obligations, because a right is a type of moral obligation. If I have a right to something, I have a justified claim to it. That's a moral thing. And you have a moral responsibility to entitle me to that claim and make sure that I get it. So there's all kinds of morality that's wrapped up in this. Mm-hmm. But if there's no God, then none of that makes any sense.
So another thing you could do in answering this question is look for something they care about. And then, again, it's all taking the roof off and
right.
Say, what if,
relativize it.
Yeah, I'm sure you can find someone that they're familiar with who's not following that rule and then say, so what's wrong with that? So, most people haven't thought about this at all. They're just repeating what they've heard.
That's right. And by the way, in the next breath, and this is the inside out tactic that's in the new tactics book, in the next breath, they are going to say something coming from inside them that's built in by God, and it's going to come out that is going to contradict that. I have a right to my own authority. That means you have no right to control me. It's a contradictory statement. If I have my own right to authority, then I can exercise the authority that I want in the way that I want by controlling other people. So how is it I have no right to control others if I have a right to my own authority? Authorities, by the way, control others. That's what authorities do.
Okay, let's take a question from Kelly Y. How does a Christian know if the person that they are dating is firstly a true believer and secondly a good choice of husband or wife?
If they speak in tongues. Just joking.
Oh, boy. We've gone there now.
No, I don't know. I'm not a cessationist.
Greg's losing it.
This is why it's important when you, as to the first question, it's important to marry someone with a track record in Christianity. When I say track record, I mean somebody who's claimed to be a Christian for a while, who is pursuing spiritual growth, like the standard stuff. There's prayer life, there's Bible reading, there's understanding of Scripture, there's going to church, there's the kinds of things that are characteristic of people committed to Christ. And especially if they've been through some difficult times and heavy disappointments and stayed true, that's best. So that's how you can know if they're Christian or not. And it's an imperfect process. Okay, first one. Secondly, whether they're a good, what was that? A good choice for you?
A good choice of husband or wife.
Well, this is a pragmatic matter, and I think that the biggest issues, and I got this largely from the guy who later on made the biggest dating service in the
Neil
world.
Clark Warren.
Neil Clark Warren, and he wrote a book, Finding the Love of Your Life. Is that it? Mm-hmm. And I think this is an excellent book. In fact, I read it, and then I actually met with him. This is before he did his whole thing. But his whole deal that became so popular, and I have a number of friends who got married using his service. And he integrates these concepts into his service. And the point he's really after there is you have to be like each other in the ways that matter for long-term harmony, okay? And the simple thing is diversity is not good. You don't want diversity in a marriage. The more diversity you have, the more capability of trouble. So if one person wants kids and the other person doesn't want kids, oh, let's celebrate diversity. No. If one person is really affectionate and desires that in another, and the other one's not affectionate at all, don't celebrate that diversity. The biggest, most obvious one, if one's a Christian and the other one's not, well, that's not a diversity you're even allowed to celebrate. If you have someone who's a very strong Arminian and someone who's a strong Calvinist, this is probably not a good idea. Okay, so there are a whole bunch of things, and he outlines them, how one handles money, because money is one of the biggest deal breakers in marriage, all right? And he goes through a number of them that I think are really important to consider. And the kind of emotional chemistry is one of the things that's in the backseat, though it's what most people lead with, because love can overcome anything. Well, the problem with that kind of love is it doesn't last. You get married, I mean, ask any married person, they're going to tell you, you know, that emotional high is not going to carry you through the real tough times, because what happens is when the times get tough, and they will get tough because two people now living together and raising children together and spending money together and making decisions together about corporate living, the conflict that is inevitable in those circumstances has a way of putting a total wet rag on the emotional connection that people have. So it isn't like love is going to, the feelings of love is going to overcome that. These other things overcome the feelings of love. And then you got to learn how to nurture in that closeness and that love in the midst of these hardships and difficulties, you know, like having your first children. Boy, there's all kinds of stuff. So I'm trying not discouraging people to marry, but most people in the West ask the wrong questions about getting married. And the best book that I've seen for this is that Neil Clark mm-hmm. Warren's book.
I've seen one. I think it's called The Sacred Search. I thought that was really helpful because it just is very, it's very practical and helps you figure out what the important mm-hmm. questions are.
Is that the same guy who does The Sacred Marriage?
No, I think it's, yeah, I think it is. Is
oh,
it Gary
okay.
Thomas or something?
Yeah, Gary something
like
or
that.
Other. They can read Sacred Marriage too. That would be good before you get married because the subtitle of there tells the whole thing. Maybe marriage, God did not design marriage to make you happy, but to make you holy.
Mm-hmm.
And that means trouble ahead.
And so one thing I would also say is that the people around you often see more than you do.
Hmm.
And sometimes they don't, and that could be a problem. But
this is why parents are so important in the process.
Yeah. So if you have good friends, make sure they're involved in your relationship and be willing to hear what they have to say. Ask them, but be willing to hear, because a lot of people aren't willing to hear when someone sees something that, you know, most people aren't willing to say it, first of all, because
right.
they don't think it's going to do any good.
Or they think they're out of place for
right.
saying something. And
so ask your first, get them involved in your life, ask your friends what they think, and then be willing to listen. I think you could save yourself some difficulties that way.
Excellent. Excellent.
Well, thank you, Greg. We're out of time.
Ma'am.
We got through four questions.
record.
It might be a record. All right. Thanks, everyone. Wow. We really do appreciate your sending in these questions. And if you like the podcast, please tell your friends and review us on iTunes and help other people find this podcast, because we love to get more questions from people and we love to have people listen. Mm. So thank you for everything. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.